Friday night and into Sunday, the same story remains. It stays blustery. We'll see some heavy showers at times. But into next week, it looks like turning drier and brighter. That's all from me for now. It's back to you, Luke.
Ben, thank you. Now on radio for the final part of our Book of the Week, Alexandria, in which Peter Stothard spends the first few weeks of 2011 in the Egyptian city. As unrest begins to ripple through the country, he records his lifelong fascination with Cleopatra and his determination to write a book about her. But his account is also haunted by characters from his own past. And in today's episode, he recalls a childhood friend who he was to encounter occasionally in later life. Their conversations were always dominated by one subject and how best to tell her story. The reader is Kenneth Cranham.
V was once the only person who knew about me and Cleopatra. She was a year older than I was, an important year older. Her heroines were Virginia Woolf and the Pankhursts. She admired female struggle. This was 1964. My Egyptian queen could have been a good example, she said, if her storytellers had not been obsessed by sex and fashion shows. The royal custom of inbreeding brothers and sisters, whatever its social and genetic drawbacks, was excellent for gender equality. What did I think about that? And how had Cleopatra spent her teenage years? I should find out. If I did not want to know how she spent the years that we ourselves were living through, what was the point of studying a life at all? There was no kind of answer in the new film, she said suddenly one day. Elizabeth Taylor was much too old. V had seen the Cleopatra film in London quite a few months ago, but would be happy to see it again with me, making her point as though this were a rare generosity. The screen on which V and I eventually saw Elizabeth Taylor's Cleopatra together was as wide as the road to London. We met no one we knew. She probably intended it that way. V and I shared only an intimacy of chance, of neighbourliness on our strange works estate, nothing more. For 3 hours, we watched a tempestuous love story as though it were a National Geographic film. Afterwards, we argued what should be in a Cleopatra story and what should not. Should an author favour what was most likely to be true, or what made the best story? Elizabeth Taylor's Cleopatra was not Alexandrian in any sense that we had talked about before, or any sense at all, bar spectacle and slush. When we left the cinema for a pub that served the underage drinker, we were still arguing about when a biography of Cleopatra should best start. The art of her own narrative was one that the Egyptian queen knew well. After Caesar's murder, the new Roman ruler of the East, Mark Antony, sent an unsavory ambassador to escort Cleopatra to meet him at Tarsus, a small town on the River Cydnus and what is now Turkey. To disregard the call would leave Cleopatra without a Roman ally and open to invasion and coups. But it was crucial that she control the staging. Tarsus would give Cleopatra little of the theatrical advantage that she had used on Caesar at home. Its unpaved streets were nothing like a canopic way between the sun's gates and the moon's. The River Cydnus at Tarsus was cold and narrow as nothing compared to the Nile. But the Greeks of Egypt had been long adept at turning any water into theatre. They never lived in the heart of their country. They always processed through it by barge, past riverbanks that were the best seats for their shows. She could not choose her Roman escort, but she could keep him waiting while she dressed her stage. She could use the time to prepare a ship that would be a home away from home. She had artists who worked in thick marble, gold, and ebony. She had others who created lighter illusions. Impressing war-blasted Tarsus ought not to be hard. The meeting between Antony and Cleopatra became one of the most famous of all meetings. The barge she sat in, like a burnished throne, burned on the water. The poop was beaten gold, purple the sails, and so perfumed that the winds were lovesick with them. It's not certain who first described that breathless scene. Cleopatra's unwanted guide may have both planned the competitive banquets and gifts and then, to make sure his work was not wasted, put them into words, describing first the seduction, then the twins that arrived the following year. Plutarch repeated the picture in his Life of Antony 2 centuries later. Shakespeare made the scene indestructible. Just as at Oxford, my career as a journalist was punctuated by brief visits from my childhood friend V, in 1979 she signalled her imminent arrival at the strike-struck offices of the Sunday Times with short, mocking, mildly abusive letters. While for me, the latest printer's dispute was yet another chance to continue with Cleopatra, V scrawled that journalists were scabs who should back your brothers. None of V's notes, however, prepared me for the shock of seeing her in the newsroom swinging her legs on a grey metal desk. Out on the broad grey pavement she laughed, and I wondered which of the pubs was the least unsuitable to take her. It had to be the Calthorpe. I bought us 2 beers in bottles, the safest choice. How are Morris and Cleopatra? I had not seen Morris for a while. He's still advertising, I said. Himself? No. Dog food. She smiled, but not for long. And Cleopatra? Well, it's not easy, I said, what with all the uncertainty of the dispute. As before, my floundering did not go unremarked. I don't think you're going to get Cleopatra around here. She looked around the pub as it slowly filled with middle-aged anxiety. What about the useless males Cleopatra had to deal with? You should write about what you know. 30 years later, as editor of the Times Literary Supplement, I was chairing a literary festival event to help readers who had never read a Latin poem before to read one for the first time. V was sitting in the second row from the front, her pale cheeks framed by dark, shoulder-length hair, a tattoo on her left shoulder. I knew immediately who she was. When How to Read a Latin Poem was over, V was sitting on a wall outside smoking a grey cigarette and rolling a second between her fingers. Our first words after more than 20 years were about how she needed a nicotine injection. Otherwise, it was as though we were still circling warily around the evils of private schools and the inadequacies of Elizabeth Taylor's director. She was never one for pleasantries. How long did you go on writing about Cleopatra? Off and on for a while, more off than on, and not for a long while. V nodded. She was pleased, she said dryly, that I'd made so much progress. There was a pause. She was also pleased, she said, that she'd seen the event announced in the Cheltenham Guide and been bothered to come. It was good to see that I was still alive. Have you been to Alexandria? She asked a question in a high monotone as though we had never met. She said she had been once with her first husband. She still sometimes found cheap souvenirs around the house. There was not much ancient to see, but I still might do better in the place where it all had happened. No, I said, I had not been, and I did not think it would help. Hotel Metropole, January the 21st, 2011. This has to be Cleopatra's very last night. Socrates reports rumblings from Tunis, the country that had once been Carthage, and which the Romans knew simply as Africa. There is lightning over Pharos and thunder threatening for miles. The square is almost empty. Even the police are under shelter. The trash of the pavements is bobbing in a river towards the Corniche. In room 114, the waste paper basket overflows. The rough book scraps and the reporter's flip pads have finally served their purpose. Mahmoud calls. Can he share my airport car? Yes, he can. We will be leaving the Metropole at noon. So these will have to be the very last words. So what did happen to Cleopatra in the end? It was June 2010, and it was my old friend Morris asking the question. His eyes were still bright. His hair and skin were not. After Antony's death, Cleopatra discovered that Octavian was about to send her to Rome by ship. She had little remaining time to decide. Octavian allowed her request to leave and prepare Antony's body for burial. She beat herself almost to death, feverish, refusing food, but relieved to learn that her son, Caesarion, was still free and on his way east and south. Morris nodded, pouring a little water on the wound on his wrist, through which the chemotherapy came. Then how did she die? Morris's question was suddenly almost urgent. Painlessly. Painlessly is good, he replied. Ignore the stories of asps or cobras, I said, or any other kind of snakes hiding in fig baskets. With the knowledge from human experiments that the Ptolemies possessed, no queen would leave her suicide to the whim of a reptile. Cleopatra was an aficionado of painlessness and pain. Painless is good, Morris repeated and ordered coffee. It was good that she had deceived her tormentor and died as she intended to die. That seemed much the best version of events. During those last nights of Cleopatra in January 2011, the Arab Spring began. President Ben Ali of Tunisia was about to escape to Saudi Arabia with a jet full of gold. A few days later, the streets of Cairo and Alexandria were filled with protesters demanding that Hosni Mubarak too should leave his palaces for the last time. Back in London, I felt a mild guilt that I had left the story just as it was about to happen. But I'd been pursuing a different story, and in the peace of ignorance, had completed it. For days I watched the Al Jazeera pictures from the Corniche, the banner wavers who passed by the Metropole and Cecil hotels, wondering if I would spot Mahmoud or Socrates, and if I did, what side would they be on? It was possible, even likely, that they would be on different sides. On the 23rd of March, Elizabeth Taylor died. For one night only, there were news images on television of another Alexandria, the place of silver and ivory, of gold, bright blue sky, and the massive application of cosmetics. 2 days later, a battered postcard of Hosni Mubarak arrived at the offices of the Times Literary Supplement. It showed the former Egyptian president in black-haired youth and black-suited severity. It carried both an Egyptian and an English stamp. It was hard to read the postmark. The message read, R.I.P. Cleopatra. All the best to you and her for another 30 years. V.
Kenneth Cranham was reading the final extract from Alexandria by Peter Stothard. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. Thank you. And now on Radio 4, time for the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on today's Saturday, the 26th.